You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work volume by Rudolf Steiner, number 205, 13 lectures entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos. This is the last lecture in this collection of lectures, translated by William Forward. This is lecture 13, given in Dornach on the 17th of July, 1921. The view that Ormuzd and Ahriman are polar opposites has led to the misunderstandings arising, as I described yesterday and the day before, which have obscured many of the laws and secrets of world existence in the consciousness of humanity. It has been the root of modern materialism, which would otherwise not have arisen, and which now imbues modern consciousness with the following idea. There are polarities all around us, which are investigated by the science of today, and which will gradually enable us to achieve an understanding of the universe. A simple consideration can show us that it will never be possible to grasp the universe in this way. Think back, if you will, to some of the things I explained to you a couple of weeks ago, and take them into consideration in the right light. Consider how those who think of themselves as natural scientists today will only view the human being as a creature who will be a corpse after death. All the other laws of nature and natural phenomena, which apply to and pervade us once our physical body is a corpse, can be explained in terms of conventional natural science. This is, however, resisted and opposed by what lives in us between birth and death. If it were possible today to take a dispassionate, unprejudiced view of the phenomena on the basis of genuine evaluation, one would draw the conclusion that between birth and death, indeed from the very first beginning of development in the embryo, we are battling against all that is governed by the laws of nature, as they are currently understood. Take the phenomena of nature around us, and everything that we are told about them by physics, chemistry, physiology, biology, and so on. Take stock of them all, and of what we are told about them, and then consider the human being living life between birth and death. And you will come to the conclusion. The whole of this life is a battle against the kingdom of nature, as governed by these laws of nature. It is only because our human organization is at odds with these laws of nature and battles against them that we can be truly human between birth and death. From this, it will already be apparent that if human development is to be integrated into the cosmos, it is necessary for the cosmos to incorporate a different set of laws, a different form of development. The laws of nature that we recognize today posit a world which does not include the human being, indeed not even plants or animals. Today we shall only focus on human beings in relation to the rest of the natural world. We are not to be found in the natural world as it is currently grasped by science. Indeed, we rebel against this natural world with every last breath in our bodies. Nevertheless, we are able to speak of the cosmos, since we ourselves have emerged from the womb of this cosmos, in the way we appear to each other in physical form. What is required is that we think of this cosmos as having a quality of being that differs from what we inwardly experience when we think of it in terms of the natural science of today. We can form an idea of what this means in practice if we allow the following fact, determined by spiritual science, to pass before our souls. Let's consider the moment at which a person dies, either young or after having reached the normal age. The corpse is left behind. We could compare this process, and it would be more than a comparison, with a snake shedding its skin or a bird emerging from its shell. The corpse is shed, and the remains are dealt with, just like the snake skin, which, according to the laws that we recognize in today's natural science, from then on no longer follows the laws governing the growth of the snake. What we leave behind as a corpse is dealt with by the laws of the earth. However, we did have the human form in our time between birth and death, human stature. This now dissolves, ceases to exist. In a certain sense, the corpse still retains this form, but only as a kind of imitation of the form it had in life. The form that the corpse retains is no longer the same as the one we had between birth and death. That form is capable of enabling us to experience ourselves within it and contains forces which come into play when we move. None of that is possible when only the corpse remains. What truly gave the corpse its form has now left. It disappeared at the moment of death. We do not take it with us. What we do take with us, for a while, is our etheric body. But we shall ignore that for the present. The key point is that our physical form, our physical stature, does not go with us. In a sense, we lose this physical form. One could spell out the details as follows. If we could follow a person's movements and their agility after the body has been left behind, once we had passed through the gate of death, we would find them different from those expressed in the physical body. Thus, what is actually present in our physical form can no longer be seen from outside once we have passed through the gate of death. The corpse is left with only the form. This form is gradually lost, since it no longer belongs to the corpse. If I may make a rough comparison, it is as if you had a pot which you tipped up over the dough for a cake. The cake would then retain the form, but it has nothing of the form of the pot itself. And one could not say that the cake you are left with has achieved this form through its own matter. No, it received it from the pot that was tipped up over it. Just as this cake retains the form of the pot when you remove the pot, the corpse retains the form of the human being when that form is removed. The form itself, however, which is the one with which we move about, ceases to exist when we cross the threshold of death. The fact that we have this form, that it takes shape according to the laws of the cosmos, as, for example, a crystal does, is a property of the laws of the cosmos themselves. We might wonder, what happens to this form? Spiritual research shows that it provides nourishment for the spiritual hierarchy, which we call the archai, the primal beginnings. Thus, something of the human form passes on into the realm of the archai. The fact is that the physical form that we take on at our birth and which we shed when we pass through death comes to us from the realm of the archai, the primal beginnings or primal forces. We receive our physical form as a result of being in the embrace of a spiritual being from the realm of the archai. We are encompassed by a spirit that came from the realm of the archai and which now takes back what was lent to us for the course of our life. This is another example of how we belong to the whole cosmos. It is as if the archai were to stretch out their feelers somehow. If we take this diagram above as one of them, it is stretching out creative force, which gives shape to the human form, within which the human being is to be found. You will only imagine your existence within the cosmos correctly if you imagine that you are enclosed in an outcrop of an archai. If you now imagine that it is only in the Lemurian age that we appear, as I have set out in the last few days, as the kind of being that belongs on the earth, gradually emerge and gradually take on this form. Then you will have what I was able to describe in my title, Occult Science. You will have a description of what the archai actually do. It is a depiction of how the archai reach down from their realm into the earthly realm and there metamorphose the human form. This continuing metamorphosis of the human form from the Lemurian age until the time when it will disappear from the earth is directed in every way from out of the realm of the archai. As the archai work at the human being in this way, they bring forth the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, in the truest sense of the word. This spirit of the age is intimately bound up with the human form in the sense that our skin is in a way given a particular shape. The spirit of the age is essentially located in the outermost sphere of our sensitivity. Once we understand how these archai work, we will also understand how it is not only human forms that are in a process of transformation during their time on earth, but also those of the archai. Now, you will know that in the ranks of the hierarchies, the spirits of form, the exousiae, are behind the archai. If you look up from our earthly existence to what constitutes our archetypal form, to what belongs to the whole of the earth's development, from its beginning to its ending, we will find more comprehensive cosmic laws at work than those already containing the human form. The Earth's development can be described as initially an echo of old Saturn, which we call the era of Polaris, an echo of old Sun, the Hyperborean epoch, an echo of old Moon, the Lemurian epoch. Only then do we reach the Earth evolution proper, of which the first epoch is the Atlantean. We are now living in the post-Atlantean era. Only now have we unfolded our human form. The earth must have more comprehensive laws than those expressed in the portion of its development which enables us to manifest in human form and its metamorphoses today. We must look back to the earth's earliest beginnings, when we were not yet fully formed, but were still present only as spiritual and etheric beings. And we also have to look at what will happen on earth after a series of millennia, when we will have disappeared from the earth as physical beings. The physical earth will continue for a while, and will even be inhabited by human beings who will, however, no longer appear physically, but as etheric beings. If we take the whole forming process of the earth, including ourselves, but going on beyond us, if we cast our spiritual eye, EYE, over the laws at work within it, of which the natural science of our day constitutes only the tiniest portion, then we will find what belongs to the realm of the exousiae. The earth took shape from the realm of the exousiae, and humanity in turn from the realm of the primal powers, bringing with us all that must be present on the earth for us to be able to exist. Looking ahead, the form of the earth will, once it has dissolved, return to the realm of the exousiae. If we now focus on the second member of the human being, our etheric body, we will find that we cannot regard it as entirely our own. Just as our physical form, in fact, belongs to the realm of the archai, with us being housed in a protuberance of their realm, with our etheric bodies, we belong within a protuberance of the realm of the archangels. That means that when we pass through the gate of death, we retain this etheric body for a short while. We know that this will then dissolve, although this does not mean that it dissolves into nothingness, but rather that it returns to the realm of the archangels. The human astral body has a similar relationship to the realm of the angels, as the etheric body to the archangels, and the physical to the archai. Our astral body is likewise not entirely our own. It is a protuberance of the angelic realm. That in turn means that after death, something of our astral body passes over into the realm of the angels. Like the other parts of our being, our astral body is clothed in the substance of a higher being, in this case, the angels. The fact that we are subject to the laws governing the earth, that we can walk about on the earth as human beings, can exert our will, do things on the earth, all subject to the laws governing the earth, all this means that we play our part within the realm of the exousiai, the spirits of form, the Elohim. Now we come to a significant point. Consider your physical form in its sleeping state. When your body is lying in bed, it retains its form. You will find it again in the morning. This form is by no means dissolved yet, nor could one say that it is a corpse, that it merely retains the shape given to it by the pot, as it were. Its form is there in reality. This means that the archai remain connected through this form with what we have as physical beings on earth. The same is true of the archangels in relation to our etheric body. They remain connected. This is not true, however, of our astral bodies. Between going to sleep and waking up again in the morning, our astral bodies are in no way connected with our physical human form. Our astral body is in completely different surroundings between our falling asleep and waking up from those we are familiar with between waking up and falling asleep. The fact is that whilst the archai principle is bound to our physical form from birth to death, and similarly the archangel principle to the human etheric, the angel principle is obliged to accompany the human individual from one condition to the other and back. The angel principle or angel being has to accompany us into sleep and back into wakefulness. You see then that a new element appears in this process when we are talking about the angels. The fact is that it depends on us, on our attitude, on our ability to direct the whole world of our feelings toward the spiritual world, whether or not our angel accompanies us out of our physical and etheric bodies when we are asleep. Children are accompanied, but once adults have reached a certain level of maturity, it really does depend on their attitude and on whether they have been able to inwardly develop a relationship with their angel. If this relationship is not there, if an individual only believes in the material world and thinks only of material things, then the angel will not come along. If you take the whole human being into account, with the earth as the work of the exousiai, the human physical body as the work of the archai, the human etheric body as the work of the archangels, and now the human astral body as the result of the work of the angels, if you take all this into account, you can see that for as long as we are awake, our angel is in the embrace of the archangels, the archai, the exousiai, and indeed all the higher spiritual beings. When we then leave our physical and etheric bodies, but with a materialistic attitude, our angel would be denying its relationship to the hierarchies of the archangels, the archai, and the exousiai by accompanying us. You can see then the situation where our attitude determines the outcome of an extremely important event in human life, namely, whether or not we are accompanied by our angel whilst sleeping. No, Our angels will not accompany us at night if their existence is denied by day. This is the key to very profound secrets of human life, and will at the same time demonstrate how our attitude to life will have its influence in the whole body of cosmic laws, as for instance does our blood circulation in the context of what is understood, or rather not understood, by natural science. Our I, capital, and its expectation of becoming an independent being is thus included in the entirety of the cosmos. It was only in the course of our existence on Earth that we attained this I-consciousness. Moreover, we did so very slowly. If we look back to ancient times where humanity still had so-called instinctive clairvoyance, we did not yet have complete awareness of I-consciousness. When these ancient inhabitants of the Earth had their particular visions, their instinctive visions, they were not truly their own visions, for their I was not awakened. It submitted instead to what its angel thought, to what the archangel felt, and to what the archai willed. It lived, so to speak, in the bosom of these higher beings. We look back to this primal wisdom with wonder today, but it is not human wisdom in essence. Rather, it is a wisdom that came down to earth by virtue of the fact that we were in the embrace of archai, archangels, and angels, who then released their primal wisdom into human souls, a wisdom that much higher beings had acquired before the earth had become the earth. It is now our task, with the help of our angel, to whom we must have a collaborative attitude, to acquire our own wisdom. We are moving toward this time. We are now also in a period of time where, having become increasingly awake in our I, we are bereft of what the archangels and angels once thought within us. The fact, however, that we have been deserted by these angels has meant that our connection with our earthly existence has become all the stronger. This connection has meant, on the one hand, that we have the potential for freedom, and on the other hand, that we must inwardly reach up toward what we can enable the higher hierarchies to bring about within our consciousness. We must strive toward once more having thoughts that will allow the angels to live with us. These are thoughts that we can only have by means of the imagination of spiritual science. Moreover, if by having such thoughts we become able to reorient our whole life of feeling toward the world, we will be able to reach the realm of the archangels. We currently face the danger that when we return to our physical bodies, at the moment of waking up, we will have no idea that we have an etheric body, or that the substance of the archangels is at work in this etheric body. We will have to relearn this. Likewise, relearn the fact that the primal forces, the archai, are at work in our physical form. We will have to develop an understanding of the moment of falling asleep and the moment of waking up. Moving forward to acquire our own I, to experiencing our own I, we came out of the realms of the higher hierarchies. We became independent beings. However, this also meant that we entered in another realm, the realm of Ahriman. Our I is now entering, and in full consciousness, into the realm of Ahriman. The earthly form goes into the realm of the exousiai. Something of our human form goes into the realm of the archai. Something of our human etheric body goes into the realm of the archangels. Something of our astral body passes over into the realm of the angels. Our I goes into the realm of Ahriman. The danger of falling into Ahriman's realm was at its greatest around the year 333 before the mystery of Golgotha. It was at that time that the transition was made to mere intellect, mere logic. Then the mystery of Golgotha took place and immediately began to come to life in humanity as a whole. It is from the year 333 after the mystery of Golgotha that the period began during which we must consciously strive toward the realm of the higher hierarchies. It has to be said that we have not yet raised ourselves back out of the realm of Ahriman, since intellectualism only really took hold from the 15th century. The fact, however, that we have been living in our intellect, that is not in complete reality, means that we are living in a world of images, in Maya. That is also our good fortune. We are not living in the real realm of Ahriman, but in the Maya of Ahriman, in mere outward appearance, in the way I have described in the last few days. This means that we can find our way out and turn back again. But it can only be done in freedom. We are living in Maya, in a world of images. Our whole intellectualistic culture consists only of images. Since AD 333, it has lain within the power of humanity to strive back up again. The Catholic Church made every effort to prevent this. It must in the end be overcome to enable this striving to happen. We must strive upward toward the spiritual worlds. 333 BC, 333 AD, 666. If you add these two numbers together, you will get 666. That is the number of the beast, during which period humanity was most exposed to the real task of sinking into the animal world. We remain exposed to this risk even after 333 AD. If Ahriman's Maya has come about, if we do not strive upward. The issue is that since we have sailed into the realm of Ahriman, right into his Maya, we have become free beings. No providence, no cosmic wisdom could have prevented us from sailing into the realm of Ahriman, or we would have been left unfree. Now bear in mind that it is one thing for us to acquire a spiritual attitude to the world, and thus maintain our astral body's connection to our angel during sleep, and another to fail to acquire a spiritual attitude to life, so that our angel does not accompany us through sleep. For in that case, what we bring back out of sleep will be the inspiration of Ahriman. That is how things stand today. The whole materialistic way of thinking, this tendency of humanity being preoccupied with materialistic thoughts, is emerging more and more quickly from our sleeping condition in the present age. Our only defense against the fact that as we emerge from sleep we are condemned to materialism, that is, being earthbound, to passing over into matter and the death of our souls, is to fill our attitude to the world with what wells up within us when we engage with the concepts of spiritual science. The sleeping condition in itself is now bringing up materialism within us. Ahriman is also trying to estrange us from our angel in other ways, and the resultant pressures are piling up. They were particularly bad in 1914. When Ahriman's forces dulled the consciousness of humanity. Our sound common sense was taken from us so that we were in a position where our angels no longer accompanied us, and Ahrimanic influences grew increasingly. This was the reason why I said to so many people that a right view of the origins of the war in 1914. We should not believe, for example, that a right view of the origins of the war in 1914 will ever be able to emerge on the basis of external documentation. Prior to that, it had been possible to do research on the basis of documents and archives. What happened this time was actually more of a spiritual nature, originating in the spiritual world, and a large proportion of those who took part in events at that time, did so without being fully conscious, but were led by Ahrimanic influences into paralysis of their consciousness, so that the realm of the angels could no longer engage with them. It has now become necessary, if we want to understand the times we are living in, to take into account the way in which the spiritual world is influencing the course of events. This has really become a necessity. Moreover, there are many other ways in which from the depths of Ahriman's realm, efforts are being made to loosen humanity from its connection to the realms of the angels, archangels, archai, etc., and to draw people toward Ahriman, to draw humanity toward an Ahrimanic culture. Just think of how often we hear today, I have said this for many years now, when someone has told a lie, a barefaced lie, quote, well, he believed what he was saying and said it to the best of his knowledge and belief, close quote. Now, that makes no more difference to the objective facts than if you put your finger in the fire to the best of your knowledge and belief. No amount of divine providence will prevent you from being burned, even if you do so to the best of your knowledge and belief. Appeals to the best of your knowledge and belief are just as useless in world affairs, and it would be a sad thing if they were not. People simply do not have the freedom to be untruthful to the best of their knowledge and belief. On the contrary, we have a duty to ensure that what we say is in fact true. We must be connected to the world in such a way that the thoughts that occur to us are born out of the world and not held by individuals on their own, detached from the world. Anything that is said to the best of one's knowledge and belief and yet is not true is invariably the result of being detached from the world. After all, if someone writes, quote, there is a sculpture in the building over there, which has luciferic traits at the top and Ahrimanic traits at the bottom, close quote. And when others maintain, as continually happens, that he said so to the best of his knowledge and belief, it means that as a result of this attitude, Ahriman has been declared the ruler of the world. For anyone who makes this assertion has a duty to check for themselves whether what they have said is true or false. It is an Ahrimanic influence, reaching even into our jurisprudence today, if we fail to pursue rigorously something that has been asserted, but is a lie, adding that it was said in good faith. This good faith is the very worst kind of Ahrimanic temptation and seduction. There is essentially nothing more seductive or tempting than these words, quote, in good faith, close quote. This good faith is nothing more than a feeble excuse in the strictest sense of the word for a laziness in people who do not feel obliged to check whether something is true or false, factual or not, before stating it. Anyone who seriously wants to counter the risk of Ahriman gaining the upper hand, quite concretely, will have to start by taking on this, quote, something was said in good faith, close quote. This appeal to good faith cuts us off from our objective context within the world. Anything that lives in us so strongly that we feel authorized to assert it must be coherent with its context in a wider world. It should not just be based on our position. Everything else in the outer world that has been deserted by the angels is left to Ahriman. Any untruth put forward, quote, in good faith, close quote, is the most powerful means of driving us toward Ahriman, a remorseless net drawing us into his clutches. Any appeal to good faith today in dealing with untruths is the best way to surrender world civilization to Ahriman. When you can see what is at work in the world, this is the kind of thing you have to understand. It does not involve general fantasizing about angels, archangels, archai, and so on in nebulous mysticism, sticking to mere theories, but does involve taking hold of the world where it really is. For it is in fact the case that humanity is losing the support of the angelic world by lazily relying on, in quotes, in good faith, with regard to matters that have not been checked, but are nevertheless asserted. These things show how an inner determination to imbue ourselves with spiritual truths and knowledge plays out into every detail of real life. Spiritual truths and research into them must send their power down into the details of life. This is just what makes so many people hostile to spiritual science. It is not a mere theory, like other worldviews, but is alive and requires people to make the effort to overcome in themselves the laziness and inner decay evident in the tendency to appeal to in good faith when representing an untruth. People do not like this and come up with all kinds of excuses for so-and-so having said something in good faith. That is what makes our science, above all historical science, thoroughly corrupt. You can easily see that people who come up with mere assertions of the kind I described earlier lose all credibility, even if they go on to make some other assertion, when they represent conventional science, for example. One has to check whether they have copied it from someone else, who perhaps belonged to the better generation, where people felt an inner obligation to test the veracity of what they wrote. When you see how people officially imitate Frohnmayr and his kind, you will realize how much trust they place in the official scientific method and its representatives. It is of the greatest importance that we face up to these things. One can only hope, earnestly hope, that spiritual science will have supporters in our time, who are deeply persuaded that serious devotion is needed to knowledge that will bring about profound change in the world. The issues we are dealing with today are not minor ones. One can only wish that anthroposophy will find supporters glowing with enthusiasm to put it into practice. I mentioned in the building earlier that people who replicate lies by the dozen have today announced a forthcoming new sensational, that is, scandalous pamphlet. These people are hard at it. Why? Because they are capable of developing strong enthusiasm for the bad feelings in their souls. They can lie enthusiastically. We will have to get used to representing the truth just as enthusiastically, or civilization will not progress any further, my dear friends. Anyone looking out into the world today must be quite clear that we have to be serious about finding our way back to the hierarchies and out of the clutches of Ahriman. This involves pursuing issues in detail. Again and again it happens that when some unscrupulous opponent promulgates something or other to the public, even our own supporters come along and say, quote, "We must first check whether or not it was some personal weakness that led to it," close quote. There is, unfortunately, always a yearning in the Anthroposophical Society to complain about something that comes from a truthful source, rather than about opponents who, out of dark impulses in their souls, would trample any truth in the dirt. As long as it remains common practice in the Anthroposophical Society continually to express sympathy for untruth, we shall make no progress. It has to be repeated from time to time that we must recognize a lie for what it is. A lie provides a hiding place for Ahriman, and it is usually a lie which, when it has been uttered, will appeal to good faith and to the best of our knowledge and belief. I have given you plenty of examples of how people have claimed to be acting in good faith and appeal to the best of their knowledge and belief. But look at the facts, and you will see the Ahrimanic influence of good faith unswervingly working its way even into our courts of law. One could say that humanity has succumbed to Ahriman even in its jurisprudence. These are things that must be taken seriously if the Anthroposophical Society wishes to remain true to itself. It must be filled with a glowing sense of truth, for today that is identical with a glowing sense for the progress of humanity. anything and everything else is merely filled with a leaning toward the forces of decline and will continue in that direction. What I am telling you today is not merely said for its own sake, but because the signs of our time are pressing for individual people to know this. That is the end of Lecture 13 and the end of the book, The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, Human Evolution and the Soul and Spirit of the Universe, Part 1. 13 lectures given in Stuttgart, Bern, and Dornach, the 16th of June to the 17th of July, 1921, translated and introduced by William Forward. Collected Works, Volume 205.